job was to set the pace, not to power the boat. With the small blade, he avoided the risk of burning himself out and losing his form, but it also meant he wasn't getting a full purchase on the water. Now he was in danger of finishing the most important race he'd rowed without having come close to exhausting himself, the last thing any oarsman wants. Still, the British bow remained out in front of the American bow with 150 meters to go. But the American boys had found their swing, and they were holding on to it. They were rowing as hard as they had ever rowed, taking huge, sweeping cuts at the water over and over again, rocking into the beat as if they were forged together, approaching 40 strokes per minute. Every muscle, tendon, and ligament in their bodies was burning with pain, but they were rowing beyond pain, rowing in perfect, flawless harmony. Nothing was going to stop them. In the last 20 strokes, and particularly in the final 12 gorgeous strokes, they simply powered past the British boat, decisively and unambiguously. The 25,000 international fans in the stands, a good portion of them Americans, rose and cheered them as their bow knifed across the line a full 20 feet ahead of the British shell. A moment later, Don Hume pitched forward and collapsed across his oar. It took Mach a full minute of splashing water on Hume's face before he was able to sit upright again and help paddle the shell over to the float. When they got there, though, the boys got sweet news. Their time, 6:08, was a new course record. And sweeter yet, it was a new world and Olympic record, eclipsing California's 1928 time of 6:03.2. When Al Ulbrichsen arrived on the float, he crouched down next to the boat and with a cryptic smile quietly said, "Well done, boys." Joe had never heard his coach speak in quite that tone of voice. There seemed to be a hint of hushed respect in it, almost deference. As the boys tucked into their dinners at the police academy at Köpenick that night, they were jubilant. The British would now have to row and win in a repechage the next day if they were to be one of the final 6 boats in the medal race. The American boys would have a day off. Al Ulbrichsen, though, was anything but jubilant. He was deeply concerned. After dinner, he ordered Don Hume back to his sickbed. The boy looked like death risen. Whatever he had, it was clearly more than a cold, perhaps a bronchial infection or walking pneumonia. Either way, Ulbrichsen had to figure out who was going to stroke the boat when the boys raced for gold in 48 hours. After lunch the next day, the boys wandered through town, joshing one another, poking into shops, taking pictures with their new cameras, buying a few souvenirs, exploring corners of Köpenick they hadn't yet seen. Like most of the Americans in Berlin that summer, they had concluded that the new Germany was a pretty nice place. It was clean, the people were friendly, almost to a fault. Everything worked neatly and efficiently, and the girls were pretty. Köpenick was charmingly quaint, grew now green, leafy, and pastoral. Both towns were about as pleasant and peaceful as anything back home in Washington. But there was a Germany the boys could not see, a Germany that was hidden from them, either by design or by time. It wasn't just that the signs "Für Juden verboten," "Juden sind hier unerwünscht," had been removed, or that the gypsies had been rounded up and taken away, or that the vicious Stürmer newspaper had been withdrawn from the racks in the tobacco shops in Köpenick. There were larger, darker, more enveloping secrets all around them. They knew nothing of the tendrils of blood that had billowed in the waters of the River Spray and the Langersee in June of 1933, when SA stormtroopers rounded up hundreds of Köpenick's Jews, social democrats, and Catholics, and tortured 91 of them to death, beating some until their kidneys ruptured or their skin split open, and then pouring hot tar into the wounds before dumping the mutilated bodies into the town's tranquil waterways. They could not see the sprawling Sachsenhausen concentration camp under construction that summer, just north of Berlin, where, before long, more than 200,000 Jews, homosexuals, Jehovah's Witnesses, gypsies, and eventually Soviet prisoners of war, Polish civilians, and Czech university students would be held, and where tens of thousands of them would die. And there was much more just over the horizon of time. They could see the sprawling yellow clinker brick complex of the AEG Kabelwerk factory just outside town, but they could not see the thousands of slave laborers that would soon be put to work there, manufacturing electric cables, laboring 12 hours a day, living in squalid camps nearby until they died of typhus or malnutrition. When the boys walked past the pretty synagogue at 8 Freiheit or Freedom Street, they could not see the mob with torches that would loot it and burn it to the ground on the night of November 9th, 1938. Kristallnacht. If they peered into Richard Hirschhorn's clothing shop, they might have seen Richard and his wife, Hedwig, at work on sewing machines in the back of the shop as their daughters, 18-year-old Eva and 9-year-old Ruth, waited on customers up front. The Hirschhorns were Jewish, members of the congregation on Freiheit Street, and they were deeply concerned about how things were going in Germany. But Richard had fought and been wounded in the Great War, and he did not think any harm would come to him or his family in the long run. "I bled for Germany. Germany won't let me down," he liked to tell his wife and daughters. Still, Hedwig had returned recently from a trip to Wisconsin, and the Hirschhorns had begun to think about trying to move there. They had, in fact, some American friends staying with them in Köpenick that week, in town to see the Olympics. The boys might have peeked into the shop and seen all of them, but what they couldn't have seen was the night when the SS men would come for Ruth, the littlest of them. Ruth they would take to her death first, because she had asthma and was too weak to work. The rest of the family they would leave in Köpenick to work as slaves. Eva in a Siemens munitions factory, her parents in a sweatshop manufacturing German military uniforms, until it was time to come back for them, too, in March 1943. Then the SS men would put Richard and Hedwig on a train to Auschwitz. Eva would evade them, escape into Berlin, hide there, and miraculously survive the war. But she would be the only one. The rarest of exceptions. Like the Hirschhorns, many of the Köpenickers the boys passed on the street that afternoon were doomed. People who waited on the boys in shops, old women strolling around the castle grounds, mothers pushing baby carriages on cobblestone streets, children shrieking gleefully on playgrounds, old men walking dogs, loved and loving and destined for cattle cars and death. That evening the boys went down to the water in Grunau to watch the repechage boats and learn who would join them, Hungary and Switzerland, in the medal race. Surprisingly, neither Germany nor Italy, the two crews other than the British, about whom Ulbrichsen was most concerned, had won their preliminary heats. Now, though, rowing under grey skies, Germany easily cruised past the Czechs and the Australian police officers. Italy crushed the high-stroking Japanese crew, Yugoslavia, and Brazil. Both winners seemed to ease up at the end, conserving energy and turning in relatively slow times, doing just enough to qualify. Great Britain, on the other hand, had its hands full with the Canadians and French, and the crew had to turn in the fastest time of the day to win their heat. But win they did. Al Ulbrichsen knew now which crews he was going to race against for the gold medal on the following day. Italy, Germany, Great Britain, Hungary, and Switzerland. But when he went to find out his lane assignment, he got a rude surprise. The German Olympic Committee and the Fédération Internationale des Sociétés d'Aviron, headed respectively by Heinrich Pauli, chairman of the rowing committee for the Reich Association for Physical Training, and Rico Fioroni, an Italian-Swiss, had implemented new rules for lane selection, rules never used before in Olympic competition. Ulbrichsen didn't understand the formula, and to this day it is unclear how it worked or whether there even was really a formula at all. The net effect was the opposite of the usual procedure, in which the fastest qualifiers earned the favored lanes and the slower finishers had to make do with the least favored lanes. In this case, as everyone at Grunau was by now painfully aware, the best lanes were the protected ones closest to shore, lanes 1, 2, and 3. The least desirable were lanes 5 and 6, out in the widest part of the Langersee. Ulbrichsen was horrified and furious when he saw the assignments. Lane 1, Germany. Lane 2, Italy. Lane 3, Switzerland. Lane 4, Hungary. Lane 5, Great Britain. And lane 6, the United States of America. It was the almost perfect inverse of the order he had expected, based on the qualifying times. It handicapped the most talented and fastest boats and gave every advantage to the slower boats. It gave the protected lanes to the host country and her closest ally, the worst lanes to her prospective enemies. It was deeply suspicious, and just what he had feared since first seeing the course at Grunau. If there was any kind of headwind or crosswind the next day, his boys were going to have to make up as much as a solid 2 lengths just to get back to even with the field. The next morning, a cold, steady rain was falling in Grunau, and a blustery wind was whipping down the racecourse. At the police academy at Köpenick, the jubilation had evaporated. Don Hume was still in bed, his fever spiking once again, and Al Ulbrichsen had decided he could not row. Don Coy would have to step into the shell again at the stroke position. Ulbrichsen broke the news to Hume, then to the others, as they got up that morning. At the breakfast table, the boys ate scrambled eggs and steak, sitting silently, their eyes seeing nothing, and no one. This was the day they had worked for all year, 3 years for most of them, and it was inconceivable to them that they could not all be together in the boat in the last race. They began to talk it over, and the more they talked, the more certain they were it just wasn't right. Hume had to be there with them, come what may. They weren't just 9 guys in a boat. They were a crew. They got up en masse and went to Ulbrichsen. Stubb McMillan was the team captain now, so he cleared his throat and stepped forward as their spokesman. Hume was absolutely vital to the rhythm of the boat, he told his coach. Nobody else could respond as quickly and smoothly to the moment-by-moment adjustments that a crew had to make during a competitive race. Bobby Mock piped up. Nobody else but Hume could look him in the eye and know what he was thinking, even as he was thinking it, he said. He just had to have Hume sitting in front of him. Then Joe stepped forward. If you put him in the boat, coach, we will pull him across the line. Just strap him in. He can just go along for the ride. Ulbrichsen told them to go upstairs and get their gear and get on the German army bus waiting outside to take them down to Grunau for the race. The boys began to troop upstairs. After a long few moments, Ulbrichsen shouted up the stairwell after them, "And bring Hume along with you." By early afternoon, the rain had still not let up in Grunau. Low clouds wreathed the peaks of the Mugelberg above the racecourse, and fog filtered through the woods down closer to the water. The Langersee was rough, the wind still brisk out on the water, the scene dark and gloomy. But tens of thousands of spectators, most of them German, began to flood into the regatta grounds, huddled under black umbrellas or wearing rain slickers and hats. Despite the weather, they were in high spirits. In the 1930s, rowing was the second most popular Olympic event, after track and field. And in the preliminaries, Germany had shown every sign of being highly competitive, if not dominant, in this year's medal round. A stream of fans crossed the pontoon bridge at the western end of the course and began to fill the massive wooden bleachers on the far side of the water. Thousands more jammed themselves into the grass enclosures at the water's edge, pressed shoulder to shoulder in the rain. 3,000 of the luckiest took refuge under the cover of the massive permanent grandstand far in front of the finish line. By the time the first race approached, somewhat more than 75,000 fans had packed the regatta grounds, the largest crowd ever to witness an Olympic rowing event. Lenny Riefenstahl's cameramen scurried about, chasing spectators out of the way of their shots, trying to keep their equipment dry. In the elaborate press headquarters inside Haus West, hundreds of journalists from all over the world tested their telewriters and their shortwave and standard radio transmission equipment. Bill Slater, NBC's commentator, opened his hookup to New York. Olympic judges tested the electronic timing apparatus at the finish line. The shortwave broadcasting boat took up its position behind the starting line. In the elaborate shell houses along the Langersee, oarsmen stowed their street clothes in lockers and began to don their national uniforms. Some of them stretched out on massage tables and let masseurs work the pre-race tension out of their back and shoulder muscles. The American boys found a free massage table and laid Don Hume out on it, like a corpse, bundled in overcoats, keeping him warm and dry and rested for as long as they could. George Pocock, meanwhile, began applying a coat of sperm whale oil to the underside of the Husky Clipper. At 2:30 p.m., as the boys continued to prepare in their shell house, The first race of the day, the foreman with coxswains got underway at the starting line. The Swiss jumped out to an early lead, but were soon overtaken by the German boat. As the boats began to approach the finish line, the American boys could hear the roar of the crowd swelling outside, beginning to chant, "Deutschland, Deutschland, Deutschland," the sound rising to a crescendo as Germany sliced across the finish line a full 8 seconds ahead of the Swiss. Then the strains of the Deutschlandlied, joined by tens of thousands of voices. Then another, deeper, more guttural roar from the crowd, and a different chant, "Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil." Adolf Hitler had entered the regatta grounds, followed by a large entourage of Nazi officials. Wearing a dark uniform and a full-length rain cape, he stood for a few moments gripping the hand of FISA's Italian-Swiss president, Rico Fioroni, as the two smiled and carried on an animated conversation. Then he made his way up a staircase to the wide balcony in front of House West and took his place of honor, looking out over the crowd and the Langersee, holding his right hand up. As his entourage arranged itself on either side of him, the crowd and the international press saw that he had brought nearly the entire top tier of the Nazi hierarchy with him. Just to his right was Joseph Goebbels. The crowd continued to thunder, "Sieg Heil," until Hitler finally lowered his hand, and the racing resumed. The crowd soon had plenty of opportunity to make more noise. In event after event that afternoon, German oarsmen charged down the course ahead of their competition, winning gold medals in the first 5 races. Each time the Nazi flag was raised in front of Haus West at the end of the race, and each time the crowd sang "Deutschland über alles" a little more loudly. On the balcony, Goebbels, dressed in a light-colored trench coat and a fedora, applauded theatrically, almost clownishly, as each German boat crossed the line. Hermann Göring, in a dark uniform and cape like Hitler's, bent over and slapped his knee with each German victory and then turned and beamed at Hitler. Hitler, peering through his binoculars, simply nodded enthusiastically each time a German boat crossed the line in first place. By 5:30, the rain had tapered off, the skies had lightened, and the crowd was in a frenzy as it began to look as if Germany, despite all expectations to the contrary, would sweep the day. In the 6th race, the double sculls, the German boat led all the way down the course to the final 250 meters, but the British pair, Jack Beresford and Dick Southwood, staged a terrific rally and won by almost 6 seconds. "For the first time all day, a queer hush fell over the regatta course," said Grunau. In the shell house, where he was checking the rigging on the Husky Clipper one final time, George Pocock paused for a moment and realized with sudden pride that, out of old habit, he was standing bolt upright, listening to "God Save the King." As the final and most prestigious event of the day, the 8-oared race, grew near, the crowd began to grow noisy once more. This was the rowing event that nations boasted about more than any other, the ultimate test of young men's ability to pull together, the greatest display of power, grace, and guts on water. A little before 6, Don Hume got up from the massage table where he had been resting and joined the rest of the boys as they hoisted the Husky Clipper to their shoulders and began to amble down to the water. The German boys and the Italian boys were already in their boats. The Italians were wearing silky light blue uniforms, and they had tied white bandanas rakishly around their heads, pirate style. The Germans were resplendent in white shorts and crisp white jerseys, each emblazoned with a black eagle and swastika. The American boys were wearing mismatched track shorts and tattered old sweatshirts. They didn't want to get their new uniforms dirty. Bobby Mock tucked Tom Bull's lucky fedora beneath his seat in the stern of the shell. Just offshore, a German naval officer stood on the bow of a launch, his arm extended in a Nazi salute in the direction of Hitler. The boys huddled briefly with Ulbrichsen as he went over the race plan one last time. Then they stepped into the shell, sat down, and laced their feet into the stretchers, pushed off from the float, and started to paddle up the lake toward the starting line. Ulbrichsen, Pocock, and Royal Brougham, clutching binoculars, made their way through the crowd and climbed up to a balcony of one of the shell houses near the finish line. All of them were grim-faced. Good as their boys were, they figured their chances of taking the gold were slim to none. Not out in lane 6. And not with Don Hume looking like a dead man. In Seattle, it was early morning. For days, department stores, electrical appliance stores, the Sherman Clay piano store, even the jewelry store, Weisfeld and Goldberg had been doing a land office business selling new Philco 61F Olympic Special cabinet radios. Despite the $49.95 price tag, Seattleites had been snatching them up. Each came with a shortwave tuner and a special high-efficiency aerial kit to assure clear reception of both the standard radio broadcast on NBC and shortwave broadcasts in a variety of languages direct from Berlin. Now, as race time approached, sales representatives were trundling the last few radios ordered the night before into Seattle homes and setting them up. At Harry Rance's now nearly finished house on Lake Washington, there was no money for a fancy new international radio. But Harry figured the older Philco he had bought back in April for the California race would pull in the NBC broadcast on KOMO just fine. He had gotten up before dawn and made coffee and turned the radio on, just to make sure it was working. Joyce had come over a bit later and gotten the kids up, and now they were all in the kitchen eating oatmeal, smiling awkwardly at one another and trying to steady their nerves. All over America, millions of people, people who had hardly heard of Seattle before the Poughkeepsie Regatta, people who had to go to work later that Friday morning, if they were lucky enough to have a job, people who had to tend to the farm chores, if they were lucky enough to still have a farm, were also starting to fiddle with the dials on their radios. The Jesse Owens story had already galvanized much of the nation, driving home what exactly was at stake in these Olympic Games. Now America waited to see if the rough-and-tumble Western boys from Washington State would write another chapter in the story. At 9:15 a.m., the voice of NBC's commentator Bill Slater began to crackle over KOMO's airwaves in Seattle, relayed from Berlin. Joyce rummaged in her purse and pulled out a small book. She flipped through its pages and extracted a delicate green four-leaf clover that Joe had given her and she had pressed between the book's pages. She laid it atop the radio, pulled up a chair, and started to listen. As the boys rode up the course toward the starting line, it became clear just how challenging the weather and their lane assignment were going to be. Rain showers had begun to slant down out of the sky again, but the rain wasn't the problem. They were from Seattle, after all. The wind, however, was gusting erratically out of the west, quartering across the race course at roughly a 45-degree angle, pushing in bursts and fits at the starboard side of the shell. Up front, Roger Morris and Chuck Day were having a hard time keeping the boat on an even keel. In the stern, Bobby Mock was clutching the wooden knockers on the tiller ropes, tugging this way one moment and that way the next, manipulating the rudder, trying to keep the boat on a straight course. The boys had rowed through plenty of wind in Seattle as well as Poughkeepsie, but this gusty, nearly sideways stuff was going to cause problems. Mock would have preferred a steady, straight-on headwind. Directly in front of him, facing him, Don Hume was trying to conserve energy, setting a nice, methodical paddling pace for the boys behind him, but not putting much into his own strokes. Mock didn't like the looks of him. Joe Rance felt pretty good, though. As the noise of the crowd fell away behind them, the world in the shell had grown quiet and calm. It seemed to be past time for words. Joe and the boys in the middle of the boat were just rocking gently back and forth, rowing slow and low, limbering up, enjoying the in and out of their breathing, the synchronized flexing and relaxing of their muscles. The boat felt easy under them, sleek and lithe. Anxiety had bubbled in Joe's belly all morning, but it started now to give way to a tenuous sense of calm, more determined than nervous. Just before they'd left the shell house, the boys had huddled briefly. If Don Hume had the guts to row this race, they'd agreed, the rest of them just flat out weren't going to let him down. They pulled the shell up in front of the starting line, pivoted the Husky Clipper 180 degrees, and backed her up against the gangway. A delicate young man in what looked like a Boy Scout uniform crouched down, reached out his arm, and laid hold of the stern. They were out in the middle of the Langrisser here. Ahead of them lay a wide-open and exposed gulf, formed by the curvature of the northern shore. The wind was worse than it had been down in front of the grandstands, pushing relentlessly now at their bow, slapping small, choppy waves against the port side. Roger Morris and Gordy Adam were struggling, stroking in place on the starboard side, trying to lever the boat back against the wind and keep the bow pointed more or less down the middle of the lane. In the next lane over, the British boat backed into position. Noel Duckworth was hunkered down in the stern, his cricket cap pulled tight on his head to keep it from blowing away. They waited for the start. Bobby Mock flipped the megaphone down in front of his face. Every few moments he hollered instructions up front to Roger and Gordy, then glanced anxiously over his shoulder to see whether the starter had emerged yet from the canvas shelter on top of the starting boat. Duckworth was doing the same next door. But both of them were primarily focused on their bows. It was critical that the boat be lined up straight at the start. Behind them, and out of sight, the official starter suddenly emerged from his shelter holding a flag aloft. The flag snapped wildly over his head for a moment. Almost immediately, he turned slightly in the direction of lanes 1 and 2, shouted into the wind in one continuous, unbroken utterance, "Êtes vous prête? Partez!" and dropped the flag. Bobby Mock never heard him. Never saw the flag. Neither, apparently, did Noel Duckworth. Four boats surged forward. The British boat and the Husky Clipper, for a horrific moment, sat motionless at the line, dead in the water. Chapter 18. Men as fit as you, when your everyday strength is gone, can draw on a mysterious reservoir of power far greater. Then it is that you can reach for the stars. That is the way champions are made. George Yeoman Pocock. Out of the corner of his eye, Joe saw the Hungarian boat two lanes over leap forward, its oarsmen already in mid-pull. A split second later, he saw the British boat do the same. He bellowed, "Let's get out of here!" Bobby Mock barked, "Row!" All eight American oars dug into the water. For another fraction of a second, the Husky Clipper sagged slightly under the boys as nearly a ton of dead weight resisted being put into motion. Then the boat sprang forward, and the boys were away, already a stroke and a half behind in the race of their lives. As he realized what had happened, Chuck Day's confidence slipped a notch. He felt it in his gut, a sharp sinking feeling. An unnerving thought shot through Roger Morris's mind. "We and the English are screwed." Bobby Mock had the same thought, but it was his job to think things through, not to panic. He planned to come from behind anyway, as always, but the spectacularly bad start meant that the two-length handicap he faced by virtue of his lane assignment was even greater now. He needed to build up some momentum, and he needed to do it quickly. It was going to be a titanic struggle to gain headway against the wind. He shouted at Hume to hit it hard. Hume set the pace high at 38. The boys dug hard and fast. Across the race course in lanes 1 and 2, the Germans and Italians pulled off the line cleanly and moved briskly to the front of the field. The British boat, once it got going, also went out hard, charging furiously back up into contention. At the rear of the field, the American boat began to claw its way more slowly back into position. As the first boats crossed the 100-meter mark, an announcer aboard the shortwave radio boat broadcast the standings to the loudspeakers down at the finish line. The crowd roared when it learned that Germany was in first place. It wasn't a commanding lead, though, and it didn't mean much so early in the race. All six boats were loosely bunched up, roughly a length and a half separating the German bow in the first place from the American bow in last place. Bobby Mock told Hume to ease off the rate a bit, and Hume backed it down toward 35. It was still higher than Mock wanted to row, nearly a sprinting pace, but it was what he needed to stay in contention. He ran some quick calculations in his mind. If he could manage to hang in at the back of the field, rowing in the mid-30s, he figured, maybe he'd still have some gas in the tank for the inevitable sprint at the end. The boys began to settle in and swing with the boat. As they moved out into the widest part of the Langersee, the winds grew even stronger. White, frothy waves began splashing over the small American flag that was flapping wildly out on the foredeck. With gusts pummeling his bow on the port side now, Bobby Mock began to wrestle with the tiller lines in his hands. In buffeting winds like these, the only way to keep the boat from meandering down the course in a series of S-curves was to use the rudder to crab the boat slightly to port, proceeding down the course in a straight line, but with the bow slightly out of alignment with the stern. It meant there would be more resistance from the water, increased drag on the boat, and therefore more work for the boys with the oars in their hands. And it was fiendishly tricky. Too much rudder, and Mock ran the risk of careening into the lane to his left. Too little, and he might get blown to his right and off the course entirely. 200 meters out, Noel Duckworth and Ran Laurie made a play for the early lead. surging quickly past Germany and into second place behind Switzerland, pressing them hard. Bobby Mock glanced over at them, but didn't take the bait. It was fine with him if the Brits wanted to burn themselves out in the first half of the race. But then, 300 meters out, Mock saw something that chilled him to his core. Right in front of him, Don Hume suddenly went white in the face and all but closed his eyes. His mouth fell open. He was still rowing, still holding a steady rhythm, but Mock wasn't sure Hume was fully aware of what he was doing. Mock yelled at him, "Don, are you okay?" Hume didn't respond. Mock couldn't tell if he was about to pass out or just in some kind of zone. He decided just to hold things as they were for now, but he was starting to seriously doubt that Hume could finish the race, let alone sprint when the time for sprinting came. The boats were approaching the 500-meter mark now, a quarter of the way down the race course, with Switzerland, Britain, and Germany essentially tied for the lead. The U.S. and the Italian shells behind them, Hungary was last. Except for the British, the leaders were all moving into the lee of the southern shore, where the water was nearly flat. The American boys were only a length off the pace, but still out in the widest part of the lake, bucking the relentless, punishing winds, spray flying from their oars with every release. A slow, burning pain started to pulse up their arms and legs and dance across their backs. Very slowly, they began to fall farther back. By 600 meters, they were a length and a half back. By 800 meters, they were dead last again. Their heart rates began climbing toward 160 or 170 beats per minute. Over in the sheltered water of lane two, Italy suddenly came up from the rear and worked its way into a narrow lead over Germany. As the bow of the Italian boat sliced across the halfway point at the 1,000-meter mark, a bell began to toll, signaling the spectators down at the finish line that the competitors were approaching. 75,000 people rose to their feet and for the first time started to get a look at the boats edging toward them down the gray expanse of the Langersee, like so many long, narrow spiders. On the balcony of Haus West, Hitler, Goebbels, and Goering pressed their binoculars to their eyes. On the balcony of the boathouse next door, Al Ulbrichsen saw the Husky Clipper coming down the outside lane alongside the British boat. Trees and buildings blocked his view of the near lanes and the boats in them. For a moment, from his vantage point, it looked as if maybe his boys and the Brits were all alone in front, duking it out. Then he heard the PA announcer call out the 1,000-meter split times. The crowd roared. Italy was in first place, but just 1 second ahead of Germany in second place. Switzerland was another second behind Germany in third. Hungary was fourth. Great Britain had faded to the rear of the field, essentially tied with the United States for last place. Ulbrichsen's boys were nearly 5 full seconds behind the leaders now. In the stern of the Husky Clipper, Bobby Mock couldn't afford to wait any longer. He hunched forward and bellowed for Hume to take the stroke rate up. "Higher!" he shouted into Hume's face. "Higher!" Nothing happened. "Higher, Don! Higher!" he screamed, pleading now. Hume's head rocked back and forth with the rhythm of the boat, as if he were about to nod off. He seemed to be staring at something on the floor of the boat. Mock couldn't even make eye contact with him. The boys kept rowing at 35, losing their battle with the wind and nearly every other boat on the water. Bobby Mock tried to fight off panic. At the 1,100-meter mark, Germany retook the lead from Italy. Another enormous roar went up from the crowd, just down the lake now. Then the roaring resolved itself into chanting, "Deutschland! Deutschland! Deutschland!" in time with the stroke of the German boat. On his balcony, Hitler peered out from under the visor of his hat and rocked back and forth in time with the chant. Al Ulbrichsen could finally see the German and Italian boats now, forging up the near side of the lake, clearly in the lead, but he ignored them and locked his gray eyes onto the American boat, over on the far side of the water, trying to read Bobby Mock's mind. This was starting to look like Poughkeepsie all over again. Ulbrichsen didn't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. In Seattle, a hush fell over Harry Rance's living room. It was hard to tell exactly what was going on in Berlin, but the announcement of the split times was alarming. In the boat, Joe had no idea how things stood, except that he was vaguely aware that he hadn't seen any boats falling away behind him. Nothing but the flotilla of motor launches trailing the field, carrying officials and Riefenstahl's cameramen. He had been rowing hard against the wind all the way, and his arms and legs were starting to feel as if they were encased in cement. There had been no real opportunity to conserve energy. It was too early for the sprint, but he was starting to wonder what would happen when Mock called for it. How much would he have left? How much would any of them have left? All he could do was trust Mock's judgment. 2 seats in front of him, Bobby Mock was still desperately trying to figure out what to do. Hume still wasn't responding, and as they approached the 1,200-meter mark, the situation was becoming critical. The only option Mock had left, the only thing he could think of, was to hand the stroke off to Joe. It would be a dangerous move, unheard of, really, more likely than not to confuse everyone with an oar in his hand, to throw the rhythm of the boat into utter chaos. But Mock had lost his ability to regulate the pace of his boat, and that spelled certain doom. If he could get Joe to set the rhythm, maybe Hume would sense the change and pick it up. At any rate, he had to do something, and he had to do it now. As Mock leaned forward to tell Joe to set the stroke and raise the rate, Don Hume's head snapped back, his eyes popped open, he clamped his mouth shut, and he looked Bobby Mock straight in the eyes. Mock, startled, locked eyes with him and yelled, "Pick her up! Pick her up!" Hume picked up the pace. Mock yelled again, "One length to make up, 600 meters. The boys leaned into their oars. The stroke rate jumped to 36, then 37. By the time the field charged past the 1,500-meter mark, the Husky Clipper had eased from 5th to 3rd place. On the Shell House balcony down the course, Al Ulbrichsen's hopes silently soared when he saw the boat move, but the move seemed to peter out with the boys still well short of the lead. With 500 meters to go, they were still nearly a full length behind Germany and Italy, over in lanes 1 and 2. The Swiss and Hungarians were fading badly. The British were coming back, but once again, Rann Laurie, with his narrow-bladed oar, was having a difficult time getting enough of a catch to help power his shell through the wind and waves. Mock commanded Hume to take the beat up another notch. Across the way, Wilhelm Mahlow, the cox in the German boat, told Gerd Wohls his stroke the same thing. 30-year-old Cesare Milani in the Italian boat shouted the same directive to his stroke, Enrico Garzelli. Italy crept a few feet farther ahead of the field. As the Langersee narrowed down into the home stretch, the Husky Clipper at last entered water that was more sheltered from the wind, protected on both sides by tall trees and building. The game was on now. Bobby Mock eased the rudder back parallel with the hull of the boat, and the Clipper finally began to run free. With the playing field more even and Don Hume back among the living, the boys suddenly started to move again at 350 meters, reeling the leaders in seat by seat. With 300 meters to go, the bow of the American boat pulled roughly even with the German and Italian bows. Approaching the final 200 meters, the boys pulled ahead by a third of a length. A ripple of apprehension shuddered through the crowd. Bobby Mock glanced up at the huge black-and-white seal sign at the finish. He began to calculate just what he needed to get out of the boys to make sure he got there ahead of the boats off to his left. It was time to start lying. Mock barked, 20 more strokes! He started counting them down. 19, 18, 17, 16, 15, 20, 19. Each time he hit 15, he reset back to 20. In a daze, believing they were finally bearing down on the line, the boys threw their long bodies into each stroke, rowing furiously, flawlessly, and with uncanny elegance. Their oars were bending like bows, the blades entering and leaving the water cleanly, smoothly, efficiently. The shell's whale-oil slick hull ghosting forward between pulls, its sharp cedar prow slicing through the dark water, boat and men forged together, bounding fiercely forward like a living thing. Then they rowed into a world of confusion. They were in full sprint mode, ratcheting the stroke rate up toward 40, when they hit a wall of sound. They were suddenly right up alongside the enormous wooden bleachers on the north side of the course, not more than 10 feet from thousands of spectators screaming in unison, "Deutschland! Deutschland! Deutschland!" The sound of it cascaded down on them, reverberated from one shore to the other, and utterly drowned out Bobby Mock's voice. Even Don Hume, sitting just 18 inches in front of him, couldn't make out what Mock was shouting. The noise assaulted them, bewildered them. Across the way, the Italian boat began another surge. So did the German boat, both rowing at over 40 now. Both clawed their way back to even with the American boat. Bobby Mock saw them and screamed into Hume's face, "Higher! Higher! Give her all you've got!" Nobody could hear him. Stubb McMillan didn't know what was happening, but he didn't like whatever it was. He flung the F-word into the wind. Joe didn't know what was happening either, except that he hurt as he'd never hurt in a boat before. Hot knives slipped into the sinews of his arms and legs and sliced across his broad back with each stroke. Every desperate breath seared his lungs. He fixed his eyes on the back of Hume's neck and focused his mind on the simple, cruel necessity of taking the next stroke. On the balcony of Hausvest, Hitler dropped his binoculars to his side. He continued to rock back and forth with the chanting of the crowd, rubbing his right knee each time he leaned forward. Goebbels held his hands over his head, applauding wildly. Goering began thumping Werner von Blomberg's back. On the balcony next door, Al Ulbrichsen, the deadpan kid, stood motionless, expressionless, a cigarette in his mouth. He fully expected to see Don Hume pitch forward over his oar at any moment. NBC's Bill Slater was screaming over KOMO's airwaves in Seattle. Harry and Joyce and the kids couldn't make out what was happening, but they were all on their feet. They thought maybe the boys were ahead. Mock glanced left, saw the German and Italian boats surging again, and knew that somehow the boys had to go even higher, give even more than they were giving, even as he knew they were already giving everything they had. He could see it in their faces, in Joe's contorted grimace, in Don Hume's wide-open, astonished eyes, eyes that seemed to stare past him into some unfathomable void. He grabbed the wooden knockers on the tiller lines and began to bang them against the iron-bark knocker boards fastened to either side of the hull. Even if the boys couldn't hear it, maybe they could feel the vibrations. They did. And they immediately understood it for what it was, a signal that they needed to do what was impossible, to go even higher. Somewhere, deep down inside, each of them grasped at shreds of will and strength they did not know they possessed. Their hearts were pumping at nearly 200 beats per minute now. They were utterly beyond exhaustion, beyond what their bodies should be able to endure. The slightest miscue by any one of them would mean catching a crab and catastrophe. In the gray gloom below the grandstands full of screaming faces, their white blades flickered in and out of the water. It was neck and neck now. On the balcony, Al Ulbrichsen bit the cigarette in his mouth in half, spat it out, jumped onto a chair and began to bellow at Mach, "Now! Now! Now!" Somewhere a voice squealed hysterically on a loudspeaker, "Italian! Deutschland! Italian! Ach! America! Italian!" The three boats stormed toward the finish line, the lead going back and forth. Mach pounded on the ironwood as hard and as fast as he could, the snap-snap-snap of it firing almost like a machine gun in the stern of the boat. Hume took the beat higher and higher until the boys hit 44. They had never rowed this high before, never even conceived of it as possible. They edged narrowly ahead, but the Italians began to close again. The Germans were right beside them. "Deutschland, Deutschland, Deutschland," thundered in the boys' ears. Bobby Mach sat astride the stern, hunched forward, pounding the wood, screaming words no one could hear. The boys took one last mighty stroke and hurled the boat across the line. In the span of a single second, the German, Italian, and American boats all crossed the line. On the balcony, Hitler raised a clenched fist, shoulder high. Goebbels leapt up and down. Hermann Göring slapped his knee again, a maniacal grin on his face. In the American boat, Don Hume bowed his head as if in prayer. In the German boat, Gerd Wohls toppled backward into the lap of the number 7 man, Herbert Schmidt, who had raised a triumphant fist high over his head. In the Italian boat, somebody leaned forward and vomited overboard. The crowd continued to roar, "Deutschland, Deutschland, Deutschland." Nobody knew who had won. The American boat drifted on down the lake, beyond the grandstands, into a quieter world, the boys leaning over their oars, gasping for breath, their faces still shattered by pain. Shorty Hunt realized he couldn't get his eyes to track. Someone whispered, "Who won?" Roger Morris croaked,
"Well, we did, I think."
Finally, the loudspeakers crackled back to life with the official results. The bow of the American boat had touched the line in 6:25.4, 6/10 of a second ahead of the Italian boat, exactly a second ahead of the German boat. The chanting of the crowd faded suddenly, as if turned off by a spigot. On the balcony of Hausvest, Hitler turned and strode back into the building, unspeaking. Goebbels and Göring and the rest of the Nazi officials scurried in behind him. In the American boat, it took a moment for the boys to understand the German announcement. But when they did, their grimaces of pain turned suddenly to broad, white smiles that decades later would flicker across old newsreels, illuminating the greatest moment of their lives. In Seattle, Joe's half-siblings whooped and hollered and cheered and tumbled about the house, tossing seat cushions and pillows in the air. Harry stood in the middle of the chaos, applauding. Joyce sat in an easy chair, crying unabashedly, rapturously. Eventually, with tears still streaming down her face, she rose to turn off the radio. She carefully returned the clover to her book, hugged her father-in-law-to-be for the first time ever, and started making sandwiches. Chapter 19. Where is the spiritual value of rowing? The losing of self entirely to the cooperative effort of the crew as a whole. George Yeoman Pocock. When they were sure that they had won, the boys rowed slowly past the grandstands to polite applause. Al Ulbrichsen and George Pocock scrambled down from their balcony and began to shove their way through the crowds on the lawn in front of House Vest, desperately trying to get to their boys. Royal Brougham bolted for the press room and began to pound out the sports story of his career, pouring his heart into it, searching his soul for language that could begin to do justice to what he had just seen. Unaware that the News Writers Guild back in Seattle had just thrown picket lines up around the Seattle Post-Intelligencer's offices. There would be no edition of the Post-Intelligencer in the morning, and his story would never see print. As Lenny Riefenstahl's cameras continued to capture it all, the boys pulled up to the float in front of House Vest. A few Nazi officers watched idly as an Olympic official reached down and shook Bobby Mock's hand and presented Don Hume with an enormous laurel wreath, so large it looked as if it was designed to be worn by a horse rather than a man. Hume, embarrassed and not quite sure what he was supposed to do with it, lowered the wreath momentarily over his head, smiled sheepishly, then handed it back to Joe, who did the same, and handed it back to Shorty Hunt, and so on, all the way to Roger Morris in the bow. Al Ulbrichsen arrived on the float breathless, crouched down by the boat, and found himself characteristically unable to find words. Finally, feigning indifference, he pointed to the wreath and grumbled to Roger Morris, "Where'd you get the hay?" Roger motioned over his shoulder with his thumb and said, "Picked it up downstream." The boys climbed out of the shell and stood at attention while a German band played the Star-Spangled Banner. Then they shook some hands, hoisted the husky clipper onto their shoulders, and carried it back to the shell house, looking for all the world in their dirty sweatshirts and mismatched shorts, as if they'd just come in from a workout on Lake Washington. A reporter from the United Press buttonholed Al Ulbrichsen on the way into the shell house and asked him what he thought of his boys. This time Ulbrichsen found his voice. "They were," he said unambiguously, "the finest I ever saw seated in a shell. And I've seen some corking boatloads." Early the next morning, they returned to Grunau, where Lenny Riefenstahl's crew and international newsreel photographers were clamoring to film them. Riefenstahl had already captured good footage of the gold medal race, both from boats and from shore, but she wanted close-ups from the points of view of the victorious coxswain and the stroke. The boys agreed to row with a cameraman sitting first in Hume's seat, then in Bobby Mock's seat. The Italian and German crews made similar accommodations for her. The results were spectacular. The eight-oared rowing sequence is still among the most dramatic action scenes in Olympia. Riefenstahl cleverly intercut long shots of the progress of the boats with close-ups of Bobby Mock and the other coxswains barking commands point-blank into the camera. These, in turn, are intercut with close-ups of the stroke oarsmen, grimacing with effort as they rock rhythmically back and forth, leaning into the camera and then back away again. When the filming was over, the boys prepared the husky clipper for shipment back to Seattle, put on their Olympic dress uniforms again, and headed to the Reichsportfeld one more time, where they watched the gold medal soccer match between Austria and Italy. After the match, the boys took to the field themselves to receive their medals. As they lined up next to the German and Italian crews, Olympic officials went down the American line hanging gold medals around the boys' necks and placing small laurel wreaths on their heads. Then Bobby Mock, the shortest among them, stepped up onto the highest platform on the podium. One of the boys behind him wisecracked, "You just wanted to win this thing so you could be taller than us for once, didn't you?" Someone handed Mock a sapling oak tree in a pot. Their names suddenly appeared on the enormous 43-foot-wide announcement board at the eastern end of the stadium, The Star-Spangled Banner began to play, and the American flag slowly ascended a flagstaff behind the announcement board. As Joe watched the flag rise with his hand over his heart, he was surprised to find that tears had crept into the corners of his eyes. On the podium, Mock choked up too. So did Stub McMillan. By the time it was over, they were all fighting back tears. Even Al Ulbrichtsen, the Doer Dane himself. That night, the boys went out on the town. All except for Joe. At some point, they got themselves into some kind of trouble, documented only obscurely in Chuck Day's journal. Talked ourselves out of a couple of places, cops, etc. By 4:30 that morning, they were stumbling through central Berlin, singing Bow Down to Washington, their arms draped over one another's shoulders. It was 10:30 in the morning before they finally returned to Köpenick, nursing massive hangovers. At the police academy, they found that Joe had been lying awake there all night. He had spent much of the night simply staring at his gold medal, contemplating it as it hung on the end of his bunk. As much as he had wanted it, and as much as he understood what it would mean to everyone back home and to the rest of the world, during the night he had come to realize that the medal wasn't the most important thing he would take home from Germany. Immediately after the race, even as he sat gasping for air in the Husky Clipper while it drifted down the Langersee beyond the finish line, an expansive sense of calm had enveloped him. In the last desperate few hundred meters of the race, in the searing pain and bewildering noise of that final furious sprint, there had come a singular moment when Joe realized with startling clarity that there was nothing more he could do to win the race beyond what he was already doing. Except for one thing. He could finally abandon all doubt. Trust absolutely, without reservation, that he and the boy in front of him and the boys behind him would all do precisely what they needed to do at precisely the instant they needed to do it. He had known in that instant that there could be no hesitation, no shred of indecision. He had had no choice but to throw himself into each stroke as if he were throwing himself off of a cliff into a void, with unquestioned faith that the others would be there to save him from catching the whole weight of the shell on his blade. And he had done it. Over and over, 44 times per minute, he had hurled himself blindly into his future, not just believing, but knowing that the other boys would be there for him, all of them, moment by precious moment. In the white-hot emotional furnace of those final meters at Grunau, Joe and the boys had finally forged the prize they had sought all season, the prize Joe had sought nearly all his life. Now he felt whole. He was ready to go home. Epilogue. Harmony, balance, and rhythm. They're the three things that stay with you your whole life. Without them, civilization is out of whack. And that's why an oarsman, when he goes out in life, he can fight it, he can handle life. That's what he gets from rowing. George Yeoman Pocock. All over Seattle, in cozy restaurants downtown, in smoky neighborhood bars in Wallingford, in clattering coffee shops out in Ballard, in grocery store lines from Everett to Tacoma, people just couldn't stop talking about it. For the next few weeks, crowds packed into movie theaters to witness for themselves, on newsreels, what their boys had done in Berlin. On their way home, the boys stopped in New York, where they rode through the city's canyons in open-top cars as swirls of paper, ticker tape, pages torn from old phone books, shreds of newspaper, spiraled down from skyscrapers. Joe Rance from Squim, Washington, stood, blonde, lithe and grinning, holding high over his head a rowing jersey, on its front a black eagle and a swastika, and running around the back a slash of blood red. By the middle of September, Joe was home, living at the new house on Lake Washington, sleeping in the bedroom his father had built for him right next to his own. Joe delivered the oak sapling that the boys had been awarded in Berlin to the university, and a groundskeeper planted it near the shell house. Then Joe set about trying to make a few dollars before school began. Don Hume, also hurried quickly home, worried, like Joe, about making enough money to stay in school for another year. Stubb McMillan visited Mount Vernon, New York, for a few days, where relatives prepared a shoebox full of sandwiches and fruit to tide him over on the long train ride home. Johnny White and Gordy Adam went first to Philadelphia to visit Johnny's relatives, then on to Detroit to pick up a new Plymouth Johnny's father had ordered and drive it home. Shorty Hunt returned in time to be honored in a ceremony at the annual Puyallup Fair in his hometown. Roger Morris, Chuck Day, and Bobby Mock didn't arrive back in Seattle until early October, after a six-week grand tour of Europe. George and Francis Pocock and Al and Hazel Ulbrichsen stopped in England on the way home. Pocock was able to check up on his father, now much reduced in circumstances and ravaged by old age, for the first time in 23 years. At Eton College, Pocock had found two of the men with whom he had worked as a boy, Froggy Windsor and Bosch Barrett, still at work in the old boat shop. The two embraced him heartily, and then brought out the first shell that Pocock had ever built, the Norwegian pine and mahogany single, in which he had won £50 at Putney 27 years before, still in fine shape, and now a favorite of the Eton boys. Pocock promptly took to the Thames in it, proudly sculling back and forth in the shadow of Windsor Castle, as Francis recorded the scene on a home movie camera. By mid-October, everyone was back in Seattle, and it was time to turn out for the 1936-37 cruise season. Bobby Mock had graduated magna cum laude and signed on as an assistant crew coach under Al Ulbrichsen. Everybody else was back in the boat. The following spring, on the morning of April 17, 1937, the San Francisco Chronicle featured dueling headlines, "Seabiscuit Goes Today" and "California Faces Washington Crew Today." That afternoon, Seabiscuit won the $10,000 added Marchbank handicap race at Tanforan Racetrack in San Bruno by 3 lengths. Just across the bay, the boys from Washington defeated California on the Oakland estuary by a commanding 5 lengths. Seabiscuit was near the beginning of his career. Many of the boys were nearing the end of theirs. But not before leaving one more mark on rowing history. On June 22nd, they rowed again for the national title in Poughkeepsie. The Washington freshmen had already won their race. So had the junior varsity. When the gun went off, the boys stormed down the river, blowing past Navy at the 2-mile mark, leaving them and 5 other crews in their wake, winning by 4 lengths, setting a new course record and accomplishing what Eastern sports writers a few hours before had been proclaiming impossible, a second consecutive sweep of the Poughkeepsie Regatta. After the race, the sagest and most ancient among Al Ulbrichsen's peers, old Jim Ten Eyck of Syracuse, finally said flat out what he'd been thinking about the Washington varsity boat for some time. "It's the greatest 8 I ever saw, and I never expect to see another like it." Coming from a man who had watched crews come and go since 1861, it was quite a statement. Poughkeepsie was the last race for Roger Morris, Shorty Hunt, and Joe Rance. By Royal Brougham's calculations, done that night on a bar napkin in 4 years of college rowing, each of them had rowed approximately 4,344 miles, far enough to take him from Seattle to Japan. Along the way, each had taken roughly 469,000 strokes with his oar, all in preparation for only 28 miles of actual collegiate racing. In those 4 years, and over the course of those 28 miles, the three of them, Joe, Shorty, and Roger, had never once been defeated. Royal Brougham watched the boys from a distance as they left their shell house in Poughkeepsie the next day and wrote, "The 8 oarsmen quietly shook hands, departed on different paths, and the crew that is hailed as the finest rowing combination of all time passed into history." Within days of the closing ceremony of the 1936 Olympics, the Nazis renewed their persecution of German Jews and others to whom they believed they were superior, with a savage and unrelenting vengeance. The anti-Semitic signs were rehung, the brutality and terror resumed and intensified. In December, Hermann Göring met secretly with a number of German industrialists in Berlin and said privately what he could not yet say in public. "We are already on the threshold of mobilization, and we are already at war." All that is lacking is the actual shooting. The larger world knew nothing of this. The illusion surrounding the Olympic Games was complete, the deception masterful. Joseph Goebbels had artfully accomplished what all good propagandists